welcome to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the classicist is Victor Davis Hansen, the Martin and Ilya Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, you've been writing recently about how some of the positions on which Donald Trump ran when he first emerged on the scene, these were ideas that were regarded as unorthodox, that they are now becoming sort of, if not the norm, at least significantly more mainstream. So we'll just go through some of these today. And I'm going to start with a point that you make in the piece you wrote about this in National Review, where you point to China, where the president really rebelled against the notion that had taken hold in Washington over the past few decades, which had been something along the lines of, we've got to work with China, ease them into playing a bigger role in the world. And the assumption there was that because China had made some concessions to markets in their economic policy, that that was the thin end of the wedge, that that would inevitably catalyze more liberalization, and that China would become, if not a benign power, at least a manageable one. What did that calculation miss?
Well, it missed that the Chinese Communist Party is a direct inheritor of Mao's liquidation of 70 million of his own people. And it's by definition communist, which means it's authoritarian. And there's very little evidence that communist regimes ever liberalize. They either endure or they implode suddenly. That's in this case the Soviet Union. So there was never any question, there was no possibility that China, because we were magnanimous, would interpret that as charity to be reciprocated rather as weakness to be exploited. And a lot of people were heavily invested. So Trump comes along and uses this archaic idea of a tariff. Everybody makes fun of him. But as we've talked before, he has sort of an animal cunning and an insight into human nature. And he understood that China was not as strong as everybody thought it was, and it was beatable. And it was so asymmetrical in its mercantile trading mode of operation, and by that I mean patent infringement, copyright theft, technological appropriation, currency manipulation, dumping, etc., that it was sort of like a shiny mahogany table, and if somebody just ripped off the thin veneer, there would be particle board underneath it. And that's what we found out, because no sooner did he do that, then he created a momentum, and then the left all of a sudden rediscovered human rights with China. And so all of a sudden we didn't hear a word under Obama, but suddenly we heard about a million Uyghurs, Islamic minorities that were in re-education camps, something the world really didn't think about since the 1940s in Germany and Soviet Union. And then suddenly we had the Hong Kong protest, and then suddenly we had these weird stories about 1984 Orwellian surveillance of Chinese citizens, where they were given points, virtue points, on computer, you know, list, almost as if right out of 1984. And these stories kept coming, and then finally they were capped off by the coronavirus, where we learned here they are doing what they did over a decade and a half ago with the SARS virus, but this time they have the ability not just to sicken thousands of their own, but to kill people abroad through their lying and their inability to be transparent. And you add all that add it all up, and people said, my God, this is a very toxic country, and its global reputation is just nosedived, and it's all played into Trump's original proposition that these people are cheating on trade, and they'll cheat anywhere they can. And so they handle the coronavirus the way they look at trade. And it's not going to be symmetrical. It's always in Chinese interest, and it's always destructive for everybody else. And it seems a simple matter. It's just obvious, but it's only obvious apparently to these people in hindsight.
How would you encourage our listeners to think about the current state of Chinese power? Because there's a school of thought that says they're going to replace us as the dominant power in the world. And there's a school of thought that says that sort of along the lines of the Soviet Union, making the necessary adjustments, of course, but the secrecy and suppression of the regime are masking a thousand cracks, and they're actually more vulnerable than we might imagine. And of course, there are a ton of intermediate positions between those two poles. How do you think about it?
Yeah, I think they're very fragile. I mean, they have almost 1.4 million, and they can't get much bigger given their land resources. but in order to keep their population stable or decreasing, they're aging. So they get the worst of both worlds. They're overpopulated, but they're overpopulated with older people. And that's going to harm the economy. There's about 400 or 500 million people who have never been to a Western doctor. So they've done pretty well in westernized or municipal areas and suburbs, but they haven't done much out in the countryside. The distance between wealth and wealthy and poor is back where it was at the eve of the Chinese Revolution in the late 40s. And so they've got a lot of problems there. They've got a lot of environmental problems. But most importantly, they were able to pose for the last 30 years as sort of an ascendant little brother to the West, that they were learning from us. They sent their students over. They wanted to emulate us. They were sort of like Japan in the 1890s that sent 250,000 engineers, nautical engineers, into Britain and France to learn how to build a modern navy. And then suddenly everybody thought, wow, they're a little brother and we're teaching them. And then suddenly, you know, they built the second largest Pacific fleet in the world. And that's what China has done. And then in addition to that, they played this sort of minority, victimized. They really channeled into Western guilt and the whole identity politics movement. And I'm not exaggerating. Just the other day, I think it was yesterday, when Senator Cotton suggested that this coronavirus was a product indirectly or maybe directly out of their weapon virus lab that was nearby the citizen or, you know, patient one epicenter. But the first thing they said was, well, you're racist or you're discriminatory or you're xenophobic, because they have the vocabulary of victimization down pretty well. But what I'm getting at is I think there was this idea that these people, these new Chinese hegemons are going to take over. And then all of a sudden people said, you know, the emperor has no clothes. They play the race card. They play the victim card. They're authoritarian. They spy on their own people. They rig the rules of trade. They're very dangerous because they're a first-generation postmodern society that has a lot of Western imported technology in their hands now, whether it's nuclear or bacteriological or virological, and they can do a lot of damage to people beyond their borders. It's sort of like giving a handgun to a 12-year-old, because they don't have a transparent society. They don't have citizen lawsuits. They don't have overseers and regulators. And yet they have all this expertise that their students and their expatriates brought back to them from Western universities. And they're very dangerous. And I think people finally are coalescing around the real danger that they pose to the world. And it's been really, in a very ironic way, it's really channeled into Trump's favor.
Let's shift over to the Middle East, which is another area where you've sort of seen the orthodoxy shift. The Trump administration got tough on Iran, did a 180 relative to the Obama administration. It's also had none of the Obama administration's compunctions about appearing too close to Israel. The concern we've heard time and again regarding the Trump administration in the Middle East, it could be backing out of the Iran deal. It could be recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. It could be killing Soleimani. What we've heard every time is that Donald Trump is going to light this region on fire. And while none of those moves were non-events, I mean, there was some backlash, they also didn't spark World War III. So why is that? Why did elite opinion get the Middle East so wrong?
Under Obama, the consensus was there's this fault line in the Middle East, and on one side there's Iran, and they're Shia and Persian, and they have surrogates like Hezbollah and the Lebanese government and maybe people in Yemen and probably Hamas. And on the other side, there's a growing de facto alliance between Israel and the Arabs, moderate regimes. And we in the United States shouldn't be in the middle of it. And we have sort of sympathy for the underdogs, the Shia. So let's kind of tilt toward Iran and balance the two off against each other. And Trump inherited that pre-existing fault line. He said, wait a minute. Israel is our closest ally. It's democratic. It's free. We're their ally. And then two, a Jordan or an Egypt has a chance to evolve, at least be pro-Western in a way that theocratic Iran can never be. And rather than just be on the side of the wrong guys or even be neutral, we're going to be pro-Israeli and we're going to be pro-moderate Arabs. And we're going to defeat Iran because it represents a far greater existential threat than does even the Gulf monarchies that have been, you know, subsidizing terrorists for a while. And we can do this by still, you know, going after Sunni extremists and bombing the blank, blank out of ISIS. So that was Trump's policy, that we weren't going to favor one side that was the wrong side. We were going to favor the right side. And I really mean that seriously. I think Obama didn't just try to balance the two. He really thought that Iran could be built up and used as a club to leverage the Arab regimes and leverage especially Israel. And that was a very dangerous policy. So what Trump was doing wasn't really dangerous. He was saying to the Iranians, what you're doing is dangerous because you really don't have the power you think you do, and it's all presumed on Western appeasement. But here's what we're going to do. We're going to ally our friends, the Israelis, with your natural enemies, the moderate Arab regimes, and then we don't need your oil anymore, the U.S., and we're going to embargo your oil, and we're going to put sanctions on your country, and then we're going to sit back and let you see how you like it. And that's where we are now. And so it was kind of brilliant, because what he did was he said that time, day by day, is in the interest of the Israelis and the moderate Arabs and the West, and it's not in the interest of the Iranians, who are losing GDP and high unemployment and high inflation every day. And they have to make the first move if they want to have the impasse broken. But it's up to them. They can either renegotiate a fairer deal, or they can attack us. If they attack us, we're going to respond disproportionately, and they can't afford to do it. And that's where we are. And I think the Iranians now are desperate to do something, either to get a surrogate to attack us where they can have deniability of culpability, or to get the Europeans, as they always do, to triangulate and try to, you know, play us off against other people. But I don't think it's going to work. Time is on our side, as it is with China.
Talk to me about Europe. This is the other region you point to in this piece. I can remember back in the Bush administration, Victor, Donald Rumsfeld, nobody's idea of a softy, Donald Rumsfeld complaining about the fact that NATO members weren't picking up their share of the tab when it came to defense. But grousing was about as far as it went. And the idea had always been that, yes, the Europeans should be doing more to cover their own protection, but that the existence of the alliance was sufficiently valuable in and of itself that you could cajole them behind closed doors. But at the end of the day, you're not going to make a big deal out of it if they don't pony up, partially because it was thought to be better to pick up the extra tab than to do anything that might send those countries off in their own direction, unleash centrifugal forces on the continent. Did we misunderstand something about Europe in that formulation?
Yeah, I think we did. And Obama, remember, he complained and said they were free riders, but he didn't do anything. And what we didn't realize was what had been the European Common Market and then the Proto-European Union had developed into a transnational, pan-continental, socialist welfare, anti-democratic, amorphous mass. And it wasn't anything like we had envisioned after World War II. And it was both dependent on the United States, but like a teenager on his parents, envious and jealous and angry at that very dependence. And Trump looked at the EU and he didn't see a lot there. He said, my gosh, there's this asymmetrical relationship between the so-called pigs, the Portuguese, the Irish, the Greeks, the Spanish, that are sort of getting ripped off by the Deutsche Bank. There's this asymmetry between the Eastern Europeans that are still religious, they still believe in borders, they still believe in national pride, and they're being flooded by illegal immigration that's dreamed up by Germany. There's an asymmetry with us, with NATO, when we pay 70% of the cost to primarily defend the Europeans, and then they make fun of us as militaristic. And there's an asymmetry with Britain that can't even get out, that Europe makes it so hard for them to get out of the European Union with Brexit. So, again, it was like a scab that he tore off, and underneath everybody said, wow, that scab was not dry. There's a putrid, wet wound in there, and it stinks. And now I think, once again, people are saying, you know what, I'm glad that he called Europeans to account. And the Eastern Europeans are privately saying, you know, there's somebody who still believes in Western freedom and nationalism and borders. And then people in the South, especially in Greece and Italy, are now saying, you know what, we do have a problem with illegal immigration. And Germany was a financial hegemon and a mercantile power vis-a-vis us. And the British are saying, wow, America's, I think Obama said, well, you're going to have to get the end of the line if you leave the EU. And now suddenly Trump's saying you're going to get at the front of the line. So again, that issue now, the Europeans are really looking impotent and weak. And you can really see it with the Iran deal, because Iran is in desperation saying to the Europeans, well, we might get out of our deal with you, that aspect of the joint agreement the United States and the Europeans had, along with the Chinese and Russians, to discourage proliferation. Now the Iranians are saying, we never wanted to get a bomb, but by the way, Europeans, if you don't give us stuff, we will get out of the deal, and you're closer to us, it's going to hurt you. And they sort of gave the game away, what their original intent always had been. And so the Europeans are now thinking, wow, we want to get back in this Iran deal, but we don't want to, we don't know what to do, because the sanctions are sort of working. If we undercut the Americans, they're going to get angry at us. So, and you know, as we've talked about before, Troy, this is a euphemism for Germany. Germany is the player that makes all the decisions. Germany cuts the natural gas deal with Putin. Germany pays 1.3% GDP. Germany lets in the most illegal aliens. Germany tells Turkey, here's some money to keep immigrant. It's Germany, Germany, Germany. It's no accident that its polls reveal that it's the most anti-American by far of all European countries. And so I don't want to be a fatalist or a determinist, but it's the only country that we have a relationship, 1870, 1914, 1939, and we're back into a polarized relationship with Germany. And it's based on the German sense of self, its capability, its undeniable talent, and its grievance that doesn't get commensurate respect and influence. And that's using the EU as sort of, I don't want to be dramatic, but sort of a Fourth Reich that it control and can get without military power, what military power in other situations ensures, and that's global respectability and asymmetrical financial and trade agreements.
So final question, Victor. You're walking us through here example after example of where there was something like an elite consensus in the U.S. and where it was wrong, which obviously prompts the question of why. Where is this coming from? Are there traits that you see as common in elites, in politics, in policy, in the media, that you think make them particularly prone to these kinds of misdiagnoses?
Yeah, I do. I think what happens is that we draw our diplomatic decision makers and many of our politicians and a lot of our so-called media experts. I'm talking about op-ed writers for the New York Times. I'm talking about the Brookings Institution. I'm talking about the Council on Foreign Relations. I'm talking about the Government Department at Harvard. I'm talking about the Woodrow Wilson School or the Fletcher School at Tufts. Whatever it is, they're synonymous. They draw a particular type of person with a particular type of fossilized view of the world that's basically our heroes are George Marshall and George Kennan, and the world was created in 1946, and American leadership, blah, blah, blah. Sounds great. And then when we start looking, I'm speaking to somebody who supported taking Saddam Hussein out, but when I look at Afghanistan and Iraq and the misadventure in Libya and the misadventures in Syria. And then when you say to yourself, we didn't have any idea about the Pakistani bomb, we had no information when North Korea had a bomb. And you start to look at all these, who was the one that dreamed up all these trade agreements that gave huge surpluses, $70 billion to Germany, $68 billion to Japan, $400 billion to China. Who are these people that did this? And a reductionist would say, well, these are people who never lived by the consequences of their own ideology. They're insulated. They're in Washington, New York. They're wealthy elites. They're Ivy League graduates. They're very arrogant. And the way that they treat other Americans is the way that they feel that the world should work. They have more in common with their counterparts in London or Paris or Tokyo than they do with people in Milwaukee or, you know, Sacramento. And I think they've been exposed. Trump was, again, he didn't invent this problem. He just tore off the scab and he said, look at these people. They have no talent. And you weren't supposed to say that. You weren't supposed to say that Hillary was crooked when she was charged, when Bill was getting $500,000 for 30 minutes in Moscow while oligarchs were trying to get their hands on North American uranium. You just weren't supposed to say that. And when Benghazi came along, Thomas Pickering was supposed to be the internal auditor of Hillary Clinton's dirty, you know, handprints all over Benghazi, and yet he was a close friend, and then he was involved as a consultant for Boeing, and he was writing letters about why we had to have an Iran deal, and Boeing had a huge contract with the Iranian theocracy. So I'm not being a conspiracy theorist, but I'm saying that these people navigated between the media, between politics, and big money and corporations, and they pose as if they were these Socratic philosophers, and this body raconteur from Manhattan came, you know, sort of like Rodney Dangerfield in that proverbial role, and he came in and he just said, you know what, this is all rotten. He screamed, he yelled, he was uncouth, Queen's accent, but he said and did things that really stayed with us and that the elite and the establishment could not refute. And they still haven't quite answered him on what our strategy is in Afghanistan. They still can't answer him why our previous policy with China was a good one. They still can't answer why we had to have all of these asymmetries with NATO. They still don't understand why Brexit might be good. And so they haven't refuted him. They just caricatured him. And it's a reflection on their own intellectual and moral bankruptcy.
You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read all of Victor's work at victorhanson.com. You can also follow him on Twitter at VDHanson. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.